and welcome to the Well Read Podcast, a bi-weekly discussion on books and reading. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Anne.
And we are librarians with the Beaufort County Library in South Carolina. This week we're going to be talking about books that are making the leap from the page to the screen. And the reason we came up with this topic was I was watching TV one night and I realized how much television that I watch right now that is based on books originally. Yeah. And it was Wolf Hall I was watching, which I know I think has ended now, but I had some episodes kind of stocked up.
Yeah.
And then Orange is the New Black came out this past weekend. The Tony Awards were a few weeks ago, and The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime and Fun Home are both books that they turned into shows on Broadway, and they both won Tony Awards, or the actors in them won Tony Awards. So I just felt like, I don't know if it's more prevalent now than it's been before, but a lot of the entertainment that I'm consuming outside of books, or outside of reading, are still based on books. Do you feel that way?
It kind of feels like every movie that comes out right now is based on a book. Uh-huh. And maybe that's because YA franchises are so big right now, and so it seems like once, I don't know, Harry Potter was big, then everyone started seeing books as a goldmine for movies. I agree. Everything seems to come from a book. It all sort of surprises me when I watch the Academy Awards and there's like a Best Original Screenplay category, because it seems like everything is based on a book.
Yeah, that's a good point. That was the other thing I thought of. The Academy Awards this year, there was Still Alice, uh-huh, and The Theory of Everything, uh-huh, and Wild.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure there are more. Those are the ones I can think of off the top of my head that were all based on books and very popular books, but very well-regarded movies, obviously. They won the Academy Awards.
I think that it used to be the books that were, or movies that were adapted from books were all classics, and now it seems like people are thinking of contemporary fiction as being a source as well, which is cool. It's but my viewing has typically been classics, and so it's sort of, when I was getting ready for this, I was like, oh wow, everything I've watched and read together, it's all 19th century British miniseries types of things.
That's
so
funny. That's to be in my book club, somebody commented one time about all the books that we had read that at the time were popular movies, because there was Gone Girl and Unbroken and Still Alice. I mean, all these books that we had read over the past few years, and there were all these popular movies, and they said it, basically I had Hotline to Hollywood because all the books that we were picking, and I laughed and I said, well, you know, all these were bestsellers,
right.
I don't have some insider knowledge,
but
it was true that I feel like that wasn't always the way that if you had some really breakout book like The Firm by John Grisham, that they would turn into a movie. But now it seems like that's the source material for a lot of films and television shows. You know, you have Game of Thrones, Orange is the New Black.
And
like
especially,
I
think television is the new version of what we've seen in movies.
Which, that makes sense to me, because I think it can be hard. One of the criticisms of that old cliche, the book is always better than the movie, is really hard to capture everything that makes a book wonderful in 300 or 400 or 500 pages or more in a 2-hour movie.
Right.
And with a TV show, they can play around with that a little bit more and extend out the storyline.
Right. And you always have someone that's disappointed with how it turns out. You can't satisfy anyone if you try to condense it into 2 hours.
Yes, and I think that there have been some movies that have done a really, really good job with capturing the essence of the book while not staying true to every single detail in the book.
Right.
I thought Gone Girl, I know we talked about Gone Girl a little bit last week, but I thought they did a really excellent job turning that book into a movie. What they left out of the movie was important to the book, but the movie was seamless without it. You could go into that movie without having read the book and enjoy it as its own piece of work without needing the background of what happened in the book.
I agree on that. I really liked that movie. I thought it was... I saw it with someone that hadn't read the book, and it was so much fun to watch the reaction.
I did too, and I kept looking at her and thinking, she doesn't know what's coming next, and is she going to be surprised?
That's a good viewing experience.
Yes, it was a good viewing experience. It was fun to go and somebody with fresh eyes, because by the time I had seen it, I had read the book more than once, because I had read it on my own and then had to read it for our book club and discussed it, and there was a lot of talk about it. And she went into it thinking it was basically just a murder mystery where you know, a woman goes missing. So it was fun to watch her.
Yeah.
Now, do you think there's for us as big readers, do you think that there's a certain appeal to when you watch a movie knowing that you've read the book, or do you think that you are a little reserved? Like, do you think you're more excited for a movie of a book that you've read, or less than you would be for any other movie?
That's a good question, because yes, I think I'm more excited just because I like seeing how someone interprets the words on the page. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I've never been someone that's felt like I don't want to see a movie because I'm afraid they'll ruin it. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people that are hesitant to see a movie if they really love a book, and I just never feel that way. I think I'm able to separate them enough that I don't feel that things are ruined. Although I will say, I've seen movies where I have been really disappointed, where it sort of surprised me at how strongly I felt that they had ruined what is great in the book. Like, I really enjoyed the Percy Jackson series, and I came out of the movie and was, and I think I even wrote on Facebook, can we just do a do-over? Can someone else option this and have someone else make this movie? Because I was so disappointed. And I never have felt that way before. I've always been like, yeah, they're two different things, and didn't really care if they made changes to the book. So
yeah, I generally feel the same way, in that I can't off the top of my head think of a movie that I was super disappointed in the book. I'm sure, or, you know, disappointed versus how I felt about the book.
Yeah.
I'm sure it has happened. But generally, I don't remember enough details of the book when I'm watching the movie to sit there and think, oh no, they did this wrong,
right,
or they changed this, or this isn't how I pictured that person.
Right.
And I mean, I have those thoughts, but then usually it's not enough to sway me from liking the
right
movie. And I can't think of a book that I can think of a book. So The Hunger Games is one that I really liked, that series. I thought that the casting, Jennifer Lawrence as Katniss, was perfect.
Yes.
Perfect choice. But I was a little uncertain about casting of some of the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
But then once I started watching the movie, I was just into the movie. I wasn't sitting there the whole time thinking, oh, they changed this, or this
right
person wouldn't have done that, or this isn't how he would look in my mind, or
right
she would look in my mind. So yeah, I think I just kind of go with it once I'm involved in the movie.
Well, I think it's tricky if you have a book that has a huge fan base, like Hunger Games or Harry Potter,
mm-hmm,
because people are so married to every detail and feel like this really intense emotional attachment to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I never feel that way about books. I mean, I love books, but I feel very invested in books, but I don't have, you know, book paraphernalia, I guess, from being a fan of something. So I remember seeing the first Harry Potter movie with my nieces and nephew when they were really small, and they hated it because there were things like they didn't have this dragon in the movie, and I was like, yeah, you still enjoyed the movie. Why did you need that dragon? That isn't the way I look at things, but for them, that was a really big deal, and as a result, the movie was bad. It wasn't just, I was disappointed that part wasn't in there. So I'm sure for other people that invest more of themselves into the characters or into the story, that it matters more, but I feel kind of lucky that I don't feel that way, because I'm just sort of like, yay, entertaining, great.
Yes, exactly. We can enjoy it on its own merits.
Yeah.
That's like TV show Orange is the New Black, just saying that. I had read that book years ago when it first came out, and liked it very much, but remembered very little of it other than kind of the overarching theme.
Right.
And now, of course, the TV show just has come out with its third season,
right,
and they have gone beyond what was in the book. That was just the framework, and now, you know, many of the characters that are in the TV show didn't show up in the book, and so it's own separate
right
thing, and you can like them each for different
right
reasons. And in fact, I would say that I probably enjoy the TV show more. There's more humor in the TV show than was in the book, but the book was very good on its own merits and for what it was
right
as a memoir. But this is something just so totally different.
Right. Well, and going back to our first question, it's interesting that when things are successful like that, because that book came out not recently.
No, that was probably like 7 or 8 years
ago,
I would
say. Now it seems like when something blows up that was a book, now things that are being published right now are immediately optioned. Whereas
yes,
I think that there's been sort of a lag time historically for books to be made into something else. I mean, with exceptions, of course, but I think that probably both of us subscribe to newsletters where they talk about books that are being made into movies, and it seems like everything right now is optioned to be made into a movie. So it's kind of fun to have that to look forward to.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's sometimes you think, well, is anyone coming up with an original idea that isn't an author? Is Hollywood just sitting back and waiting for authors to come up with their next book? So.
Yeah, and I'm curious if the reason that so many books are being optioned is because people who make these decisions in Hollywood think that it's such a great idea or concept,
mm-hmm,
or if they think there's a built-in audience there for it. I wonder if it's a combination of both.
Yeah,
or,
probably.
I'm guessing, yes. The Hunger Games, I'm guessing it was a combination of the fact that they knew there were these millions of people that had read the books and all the books. But, you know, having worked in the library when those movies have come out and seen the popularity of the books just on their own and then the popularity of the books based on people who saw the movies and wanted to come back, there were a lot of people out there that didn't read the Hunger Games until they saw the movie.
Right.
And then went back and read them until after the first one or second one came out.
Well, and I think there's a lot of book series that come out that they go into it thinking that there's a built-in audience and then the movie doesn't do very well and you sort of wonder, why did this not bridge the gap? Like, I really enjoyed I only read the first book in The City of Bones, or The Mortal Instruments, I think is the name of the series, but City of Bones is the first book. And the movie just tanked. So why didn't all those fans, because it's a huge popular series and it's still going on, why doesn't that make a lot of money? I don't know.
And that's one, that's an interesting case, because now they're making a TV show out of it.
Really?
Yes.
Ooh.
That is one. I just was reading about it, but that movie did terribly in the box office, but now they're taking it, and now they're turning it into a television series, you know, with all new actors and but the same. I know. And that would really work. I read that series.
Yeah.
And that will, or most of that series, and that I think will really work as a television series versus, I didn't see the movie, but versus trying to condense it into a couple of hours.
It was an okay movie. Like, I enjoyed it. Okay. But I think I was so surprised that I liked the book, because I typically don't do fantasy novels at all, and I was just completely like charmed by it for some reason. So I don't know, I was okay with the movie, but it wasn't amazing or anything. So
all right, so now that we've talked about some of the projects that have been books into movies or TV shows and the appeal of those, we have some suggestions for you on some books that either have been or will be making the leap onto the screen. And you want to tell us about your first pick?
Sure. So since my background in watching and reading the same thing is very much only in the realm of 19th century classics, which I was kind of sad to realize once I started prepping for this, I decided to go with a classic novel that's a little under the radar. So the book I picked was The Enchanted April by Elizabeth von Arnim. And just some background on her, she was an English woman who was married to a Prussian aristocrat, and then also, after he died, married a second time, and both of these marriages were very unhappy, and that really informs the book, The Enchanted April. But she also must have lived a very interesting life, because she was the mistress to H.G. Wells, and she was well acquainted with all kinds of the literati of the age, so I think that she was friends with Ian Forster, and her cousin was a famous writer, and so she was very much in the middle of that writing circle that became very famous, but she didn't necessarily become famous, or at least hasn't really become a household name the way these other people have. So she started writing as a refuge from these bad marriages, and The Enchanted April came out in 1922, so that's the time frame that we're talking for this book. So the basic plot of the book is actually not very extensive. There are four women that don't know each other, and they're all living in London, and it's cold and rainy, and they're kind of miserable with their lives, and one of them sees an ad in a newspaper, and I wrote down what the ad actually says, because it's so intriguing to me. So it says, "To those who appreciate wisteria and sunshine, small medieval Italian castle on the shores of the Mediterranean to let." And so that's just the jumping point for this book, where one woman reads this ad and just can't get it out of her head, and finds three other women that will go with her to this castle, and so they can all afford to stay there together. And so each woman is really different. None of them, they all are kind of in unhappy situations or sort of not at peace with the place they are in their lives. And so they go to the Italian Riviera and sort of find themselves. And that's basically it. Which now I think is a little, there are a lot of books that have that same formula, maybe with a little bit more conflict thrown in there. And there's some conflict in this book. They are either all married or have a lover or just have some sort of monotonous existence that they're trying to escape from. And so then once they sort of become happier with their lives, then they invite these people that they're tied to this castle to sort of have the same magic worked on them. And there's some conflict that comes from that. But not a lot. Most of the book is just atmosphere and sort of the setting and thoughts on what it means to be a woman in the 1920s. So even though this basic structure has really been taken and run with, then in modern literature, then at the time, I think it probably wasn't the most common thing you would read. So like I said, there's not, when you read it, you're just sort of thinking, this is just such a lovely existence that they have, and this is so beautiful, and there's you're not reading it really to find out what happens next. It's just beautiful atmosphere. So one thing I found out when I was researching this, I thought was really interesting, is this book is credited for starting the tourism industry in the Italian Riviera. That really hadn't been a place that people went, and people did the grand tour of Europe, but this idea of just going and kind of sitting by the sea and being in such a beautiful setting in Italy kind of came from this book, which is really cool, I thought. So the movie, I also hadn't known that there were lots of adaptations of this movie, or of this book rather. It was an instant bestseller, and I think that there was a play that was written and a movie that came out in the 30s maybe. But the version that I saw came out in 1992, and it's directed by Mike Newell. And it has lots of famous British people in it that you maybe know from other things since then. I think that the guy that is in Foyle's War is in the movie. I can't think of his name right now. And just lots of people that are familiar faces if you watch any British television, but they're all in this very kind of low-key, very small independent movie. And my dad took this to see me when it came out, and I was probably too young to have seen it, and I remember not just being like, oh, this is really beautiful, but I didn't understand sort of the interpersonal relationships at all that were going on. And then I read the book in college, and it's just a lovely, lovely book. So I recommend both the movie and the book very, very highly. If you ever need sort of a blissful, kind of vegged out afternoon, this is the movie to watch.
Yes, I have not read that book, but I've seen the movie, and it will make you want to go to Italy.
Yes.
I mean, it really will. It's just, like you said, the atmosphere and the scenery in the movie is so beautiful. In fact, I think it's on Netflix streaming,
okay.
I think, or of course you can always go to your library and see if they have it. But it's one that I haven't seen in a few years, but I remember that lasting impression of just such a lovely movie, and it just makes you want to go.
Yeah.
To the...
Well, there's that lovely scene where they first get to Italy and it's pouring rain, and they someone picks them up. They don't speak any Italian, and they end up at the train station, and someone is picking them up, and they're all sort of horrified by the person trying to take their baggage, and then they finally get to the castle, and then the next morning they wake up, and there's this scene where they open the window, and you just see this vista.
Oh.
It's so gorgeous. So I have seen this movie so many times, and I'm really glad that as a kid it stuck with me so much, because there are lots of things that you see as a kid that sort of just pass over your head. So I'm really glad this, not really appropriate for a 12-year-old kid movie, ended up making such an impression on me. So
yeah. I like it a lot. I'll have to read the book and watch the movie again.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. All right, well, my first one is a book that the movie is not out yet. It is set to come out in October. I will describe the book, and then we can talk about the movie a little bit. It's called The Martian by Andy Weir, and it is about a group of astronauts who are on a mission to Mars, and they get caught in a freak dust storm. And as they're moving to try to get back to the vehicle that's going to send them up to rocket ship, for lack of a better word, I realize that is not the technical term. One of the members gets struck by some debris and is knocked out, and his spacesuit is punctured. And because of that, their like bio signs wired into his spacesuit to be read by the people on Earth that are running the mission, as well as his crew members.
Uh-huh.
And so for all intents and purposes, everybody thinks he has died because he is out cold, and all of the pulse readings and everything are showing he's brain dead, and everything's reading like a flat line.
Mm-hmm.
So he's dead. So they have to make this terrible decision to leave him behind. And they decide to go back to Earth. And then soon after, he wakes up.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is Mark Watney. And he realizes that he is all alone and that they have left him, and he's on this uninhabitable planet, and he thinks, well, I'm pretty much screwed. You know, this is not going to go well. He has a limited amount of food because they were only planning on being there for a certain amount of time, and he has no way to communicate with everybody back on Earth or his crew members because all of their communication systems have been knocked out because of this storm.
Mm-hmm.
He is a botanist as well as an astronaut, and so the first thing he thinks of is how to grow food on this planet. And they have some potatoes and a little bit of soil that they brought with them, and he starts planting them in, they have what they call a hab, which is like the structure a very small structure that they can work out of when they're trying to explore Mars. And so he starts sort of MacGyvering his way in this cab to plant some potatoes, and he works out all the math of how many days that he can live based on what limited food stores they had, as well as being able to grow some potatoes, because there's another mission that's coming to Mars in something like 4 years. So if he can just last those 4 years and then another mission can come, then he'll be able to get back to Earth. And then he also is trying to get the communication systems back up and running so he can communicate with them and tell them back home that he is still alive and that they know that they need to help him. Mm-hmm. This is an interesting story about the book because the author had written it, and he has a background in computer science, I believe. He's sort of like a technical guy. And he had written it, and every publishing house had turned it down. And so he decided to publish it serially, chapter by chapter, on his website. And as people would read it, they would comment on the realistic nature of the science that he was using and whether it was possible some of these things that he was presenting could actually help this man survive. So he was getting all this feedback. So from what I've read, this is actually very scientifically sound.
Oh,
that
cool.
What he puts forward are things that could actually potentially work.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit, some of the science got a little bit over my head. Like, he writes it in a very readable way, but I just sort of would skim over those parts because it's really more of an adventure story to
right.
me, and some of the scientific parts of how he was making his life work wasn't quite as interesting to me. But as a story as a whole, it was very, very interesting. And he has a great, funny, dry, kind of smart alecky tone as he is telling the story. He's doing it all as sort of like a journal format as he's there. And so you're reading along with him, and it's very intense because this is life or death for him.
Yeah.
You know, he's trying to survive and trying to figure out all these problems. And it's sort of like if Apollo 13 and Robinson Crusoe and Castaway all came together, because he's all by himself, but you have the space aspect. And so, and it's not the whole, I don't think I'm giving away anything by saying that the whole book doesn't just focus on him on Mars. You know, you do get the story of what's going on Earth
okay. And
what's happening with his crew. That's a lesser part of the story, but there's a glimmer of hope that he will be potentially reunited with them, not reunited, I shouldn't say that, like they make contact with them. And so you do get a little bit of what's going on there. So it's really interesting. And then the movie is coming out in October, like I said. Matt Damon is playing the lead role, and it's directed by Ridley Scott. And the trailer looks amazing. I'll link to it on our website when we do our list of what we talked about today. And it's really good. It's got a great cast. It includes Jessica Chastain and Kate Mara and Kristen Wiig and Chiwetel Ejiofor and Jeff Daniels. And so it's a really star-studded cast.
Yeah, that sounds really fun.
And it looks like, again, like you said, it's hard just from a preview to tell, but it looks like they've done a really good job of translating the book, which is all, like I said, his thoughts for the most part, and then scenes of what's taking place on Earth as they're trying to figure out what happened, and satellite pictures of Mars and stuff.
Right.
And so it looks like there's kind of a voiceover in the movie, so you're still getting his jokes that he makes or his thoughts, but you're also, it's more visual, of course, as the movie. So it looks really, really good. I'm looking forward to it. And this was a surprise bestseller in that, like mm-hmm. I said, he originally wrote the book and self-published it after he had vetted it through his website, and then a major publishing house bought it, and then the film rights were acquired for something like $100,000, and then now they're making a film out of it. So it's a true success story for
yeah.
him as an author, and it's just a really interesting story. It's not really my typical kind of book that I would pick up, but I've heard so many good things about it, and from people that read very similarly to me, and I thought, well, you know, if they like it, it sounds science fiction, of course, it's called The Martian, and I was like, well, but if they like it, I should give it a try, and I was really happy I picked it up, because it's really entertaining, and it's very interesting, and like I said, it's a great adventure story.
Yeah, it's always really scary when a book that has one person in it is made into a movie or a TV show, because that's a really hard leap, I think, to make it so that it isn't just all voiceover,
mm-hmm.
and you're getting thoughts, and you're also just not watching someone walk around at the same time, so I'm always kind of dubious of those. So it's good that it sounds like it's, like the trailer looks like it'll be effective.
Yes, the trailer makes it look very easy to watch
yeah.
these events happening.
Yeah.
And they show all those other characters, so you know that it's not just about him and showing him.
Right.
All right, and what's your next book?
I picked a book called Written in Blood by Caroline Graham. This is one, the book is part of a series that was made into the Midsummer Murders series that's really, really popular. I don't know about your branch of the library, but these are never on the shelf where we are. We just, they're so incredibly popular, these mysteries DVDs. So, but I think most people don't know that there's actually a book series that was written in the 90s. And I first found the series, I was living in Europe, and it just came on television kind of late at night, and I love mysteries, and so I was sort of intrigued by it, and I just fell in love with it. I thought that the setting, it's kind of set in this like quaint British town setting. It's supposed to be all in one sort of made-up county in England, which is the most murder-filled county on earth. So, which is kind of hilarious, but it has this, it's very cozy. There, all these people know each other. The murders are not kind of big conspiracy sorts of things. It's just people that have secrets that are trying to keep their secrets from their neighbors. So, which is my favorite type of mystery. So, so when I watched this episode, the episode I happened to see was the episode that is adapted from this book, so I picked that as sort of the representation for talking about that. I think there's 7 books in the series, and I think this is the 4th one. It's right in the middle, and obviously the TV series has gone on much, much, much longer than just the 7 books that have been written. It's kind of where they took the characters and just made a bunch of other 25 seasons of extra mysteries to go along with it, but they have filmed all of the books that were written originally by Caroline Graham. The book is centering around a writer's group that meets in this small English town, and they're never able to get anyone to come talk to them as kind of a success story, so they finally get someone that is willing to come speak, and everyone's really excited that this major author has said he'll come talk to them about his craft, except for one man in the group, and he won't tell anyone why he's so furious, and then he turns up dead. So the inspector in the series is named Inspector Barnaby, and so he's investigating, but it's done in the typical way that this, basically every episode sort of has the same format, multiple storylines that are going on, and the book is really made the same way, where you see all these different people that are in the town, they all have a secret, they all are kind of involved with each other, but not the secrets aren't necessarily the same thing, but you're not sure if they're going to intersect at certain points, or if it's just going to be a completely different storyline. In the book, I feel like the series is a little more, not necessarily lighthearted, but you get to see all these pretty houses and pretty English countryside, so it feels a little bit lighter than the book does. And the book, you're in everyone's heads, so you see sort of the backbiting that they're doing in their heads towards each other, and sort of how little they respect their neighbors, and so it can feel a little bit claustrophobic, but in a way that's really effective for the book. So there's not, I don't want to give too much away about the mystery. There's really not much more to it other than that's the jumping point for what happens. I remember there's a part in the show and in the book, but the show is particularly effective in showing this, that just sort of floored me when I watched it. It was so startling to me, and it's kind of the big reveal, but yeah. there was just this moment that really, really creeped me out in kind of like a delicious way, and it stuck in my head for many, many years since then. So that made me a fan for their ability to do that. But I think that the book series is kind of unfortunately not as well known as I think it should be.
Yeah, I had no idea that series, the TV series, was based on a book, or on the set of books. I had no idea.
I'm sure at the beginning, it's been a while since I've watched the show, but I'm sure at the beginning it says based on either the book or by characters by Caroline Graham, but I've never had anyone come in and say,
no, me neither.
Can you get me this book series? And a lot of things that come out on TV or in movies will have a lot of requests for people for us to bring in the books that go along with them. And this one, I just don't think that they I think that they've probably not been printed since the 90s as well. So I don't know if they're more popular in England or if it's, enough to get made into a show. But but here they're just, I don't think we even have them at least in my branch, we don't have them on the shelves. So, which is unfortunate because they're really well done mysteries.
All right, well, my next one is a book where the movie is in development. It doesn't even have a set date that it's coming out, nor has it started filming yet. But it's one that I wanted to talk about because I really enjoyed it, and I think that it will give people an opportunity to read it before the movie comes out versus just seeing the movie. It's called Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and it is about a young Nigerian woman named Ifemelu, who is smart and driven, and she reluctantly leaves her home in Lagos in Nigeria for America on a college scholarship. And Nigeria is under a military dictatorship, so people are leaving the country as quickly as they can or if they can. Mm-hmm. And she, when she was growing up in secondary school, met a man named Obinze, and they developed a friendship and eventually fell in love. And he is planning on coming with her to America for her schooling, but he is denied an American visa. But he also wants to get out of Nigeria. So he ends up in London. So she's in America and he's in London. And the book examines both of their efforts to assimilate and support themselves and how difficult that can be as somebody new to a country and as a black person in both of those places.
Yeah.
And Obinze ends up where he needs to get somebody else's identity just to get a job there. He cannot even get a job on his own. And so he borrows somebody else's identity, and it's a menial job that he gets, but it's a constant struggle to avoid getting found out that he has this different identity. And eventually, unfortunately, he is found out and has to return to Nigeria, but then is very successful in Nigeria. So there's one aspect of the story which follows him and what happens to him. And then Ifemelu is the main character of the book. And it follows her in America. And like I said, she's very smart and she goes to school, but she has a terrible time trying to support herself. She is sent on a scholarship, but basically just to cover her schooling, not to cover her living, and cannot find a job. And she has to do some things that really are distasteful, is a nice way of saying it, I mean, very degrading to her. And because of that, she separates herself from Obinze. She stops talking to him. And she starts noticing, as an outsider, she has the chance to observe race in America. And she starts a blog, and it's all about the things that Americans treat people of different backgrounds and different cultures and different races and different religions. And it becomes wildly, wildly popular because she's very, got this astute way of observing things in a very funny way. She's got a very witty way of writing, and it's very sharp and insightful. Because of that, her life takes a different path than what she was thinking based on how she started. And the book is a lot of different things. There's a love story there, but there's also a portrait of race in America and England, and a look at what it means to have a national identity and to love your home country and what that means, and how difficult it is to assimilate into a new culture and a new country, and also just a basic story of trying to succeed no matter where you are. There's a lot. It's a, would be a great book club pick, I think. There's just a lot to talk about. And it's not too strident, I wouldn't say. I think that there are a lot of pointed observations that might take people aback a little bit, where they might think, wait, you know, is this something that's happening? And you know, we're two white women, so it can be hard. We don't know a lot of the things that would happen if you were a minority or foreigner in a different... Well, you did live in a different country, so you might really...
But in a white...
Yeah, in a way, but you know, where there's still that outsider status, though. So there's just a lot that I really enjoyed it. I read it last year, and I think it was one of the best books that I read last year because it really opened my eyes to some things. But it's also a great story. And I, you know, I don't want this just like political tirade about race in America. I mean, there was still a really good story while having these really trenchant points that she was making.
Yeah.
And the movie, like I said, is in development, so I have no information about when it's coming out. But Brad Pitt is producing it, and Lupita Nyong'o and David Oyelowo, who he was in Selma, right? And they're both Academy Award nominees.
She won. Yeah.
That's
a great cast.
A really good cast. Yeah. And I learned that after I read the book, but I can totally picture her as the main character. And then I don't think it's been said which role he's playing. There are several different roles that would be possibilities for him to play. They're both really good actors. And then Brad Pitt's company is producing it, and they have a pretty good track record for movies. So it's one I'm looking forward to. But it's just, in general, it's a great book that I think a lot of people would enjoy.
Yeah. Is the author Nigerian living in the United States?
I believe so, yes. She has written, I think this was her third book, and I haven't read her first one, but her second one, Half of a Yellow Sun, was about the Nigerian Civil War in the 1960s. It was definitely Nigeria in the 1960s, and I believe there's civil upheaval, if not a war going on at the time. And then now this is sort of after that, you know, whole different set of characters and things,
right. But
what's going on in Nigeria after that.
That sounds so interesting. I've heard such good things about that book, and I just haven't read it yet. But probably because there's a movie coming out, it'll encourage me to read it faster.
And I should say, Americana, that it's spelled A-M-E-R-I-C-A-N-A. N-A-H, and that is how Nigerians refer to people who have left Nigeria to go to America, or really to another country, and then come back to Nigeria, and how they sort of take on some different tendencies because they have been in this other country, and then they try to come back to Nigeria. So that's where the title comes from.
Interesting.
It's very interesting.
That sounds very, very good. I'm excited to read that.
Yes. All right,
more than I was before. I already was excited.
Give me your last one.
Okay, so my last book is called The City of Ember by Jean Duprow. And this is a children's book. I think it's also kind of considered YA. I would put it at maybe like the 12-year-old sort of tween age. It's kind of dark, so I wouldn't necessarily call it a children's book, but it's written a little younger than YA. The setting is really what made me love this book. It's set in an underground city called Ember that's lit only by electricity. So you already are setting yourself up for these gorgeous images of kind of like Edison light bulbs over everything. When I saw this movie, I was really excited just for the visuals on it. The background on Ember is that it's a city that was founded hundreds of years ago after some event that we don't know in the book what has happened. But it was set up by founders who wanted the city to survive. So they have all kinds of storerooms full of food. They've come up with a planting system, and there are generators. They're in for the long haul. But at this point in the book, when it opens, the city is beginning to fall apart, and there's a lot of corruption, and they sort of are on their way out as a civilization. So the protagonist of the book is a 12-year-old girl named Lena, and she finds this parchment that indicates that there could be life outside of Ember. And I think in the book that they just don't know that there's anything besides this, because the city has been there for hundreds of years at this point. So she starts to investigate, but there are people that are higher up in society that don't want this information to come out. So she is kind of on her own in trying to find out what this parchment means and sort of figuring out the mystery of this. And so she recruits a boy who, I think it's been a little while since I read the book, but he's also sort of questioning how the city is run. His name is Dune. And so they're trying to solve this mystery of what this parchment means, if there's life outside of Ember, how they can get to life outside of Ember, and how to survive when they're running out of food. The city is kind of plunged into darkness periodically because the generators are going down, and they're at the same time there's enemy that's trying to stop all of this from happening. It's definitely a science fiction book, but it has kind of this noir feel to it that I really enjoyed, and I like, you don't do a lot of science fiction, so it has more of kind of a Metropolis feel versus spaceships, which is my kind of science fiction. It's just sort of this sort of dystopia, but a little more I don't know, technological, I guess, than the typical dystopia that I've read in the past. So when I first read this book, I didn't know it was the beginning of a series, and I can't remember how many books are in the series now. I've read three of them, and the first book is really satisfying as a read alone title, but then the later books sort of flesh out what has happened in the past and what happens after the events of this book. But so you're not just sort of left wondering the event that got them into Ember in the first place, but there's a lot more that you find out as you read through the series. The movie, this is the only one in my list of books where I had read the book before I saw the movie, but the movie came out in 2008, and it's just beautifully filmed. Like I said, the Edison light bulbs every place are just so appealing to me, and then they got all popular every place, so it's kind of funny this movie came out before hipsters claimed this light bulbs as their primary light source. So it's a good children's movie, but it also has sort of these darker themes that are going on in it. So it makes it very interesting for adults. So the movie stars the girl that is in Hannah. She's also in Atonement, I think. And she's just a really, really good actress. So there are really good performances. It's visually beautiful. I really enjoyed the movie. Unfortunately, they did not make any more of the
I was
movies.
Going to ask that if they continued on.
I don't think
no.
so, but I think in the they changed some things in the movie that I don't think are in the book to make it a little more self-contained in the movie. So I don't think they necessarily needed to, and I don't know if there were any plans to continue the series. It worked well for the way the movie ends.
Okay.
So
yeah, I've heard good things about that, but I don't think I've ever... I definitely have never picked it up, and I don't think I've seen the movie, so
yeah.
It sounds good. It sounds like my kind of like sci-fi fantasy kind of.
Yeah, and there's so much good children's literature that's coming out, and we've talked about our love for YA, but I kind of tend to ignore children's lit a lot.
Yeah,
I think this is one that I read when I was in grad school and for a children's lit class, and just was really intrigued by it. So I liked it a lot. I hope people read it.
I think they will after that description.
Yay!
All right, so my last one is Big Little Lies by Leanne Moriarty. And this is another one that is in development, but it's going to be coming out on HBO at some point as a limited series show, sort of like how they do True Detective, you know, right. Just the story takes place over a certain number of episodes. This is a book where it opens with someone falling off a balcony and dying at the trivia night at the local school in Australia. It takes place in Australia. Yeah. It's not clear who the victim is or whether or not they were pushed or just fell. So there's a mystery element that you don't find out until the end who exactly is involved in this event that takes place at the beginning. And then the book jumps back 6 months, and it's the start of the school year, and there's a woman named Madeline McKenzie, and she's enrolling her daughter in the local kindergarten, and she meets Celeste, who is the mother of twin boys, and she's gorgeous, and she seems to have her life all together. She has a very successful husband, and it just seems like she has this perfect life. And she also meets Jane, who is a single mother. She's very shy. She's sort of jumpy, nervous kind of person, and she's enrolling her son, Ziggy, in the kindergarten as well. Soon after they all come together, Ziggy is accused by another girl in the kindergarten class of having bullied her, basically. And immediately all the parents take sides of either they're defending this child because he's very sweet-natured as that he couldn't possibly have done it, or the other side that obviously he did it, he should be basically kicked out of school because they don't want that behavior there. I don't have children, but from what I understand, these sort of cliques and arguments and these things that happen among parents of kids that are in school do happen. So I think that from what I've heard from people who have read this book, she does a very good job of setting out the ways and how this affects everybody's life when you have the parents so involved in their children's lives and making things hard for other people based on personal conflicts,
right.
If that makes sense. Through the next 6 months, you're following the story as tensions mount, all based on this original event of this accusation of bullying. And then it all comes to a head at the trivia night and then to the event where somebody has died. And interspersed with that story are snippets of interviews with the witnesses at the trivia night. So you're piecing together what exactly happened as the story is going along, at the same time getting involved in the characters' lives of the mothers. Leanne Moriarty, I think, writes women very well. She has these really three-dimensional, fully formed characters that you believe, these are like people that you could know in real life. And although it sounds sort of light and chicklity as far as their parents of kids in elementary school, there's a little bit of darkness here too, like very real issues that are going on in women's lives and how things that look one way on the surface underneath aren't always that simple. And I think she does a really, really good job of displaying that and how you can't assume things from the way people look or how their life looks on the outside. And I know you read this, Anne. What did you think?
No, I actually haven't read this one.
You haven't read this one?
I read The Husband's Secret, which I wasn't as crazy about, but I've heard from friends that also didn't like The Husband's Secret that have read this one,
yes.
That this one they love.
Yes.
And her first book, or the book she wrote before The Husband's Secret, my sister and one of my best friends just adored it, and then they were disappointed by The Husband's Secret, and then they loved this one, so it felt like she was kind of back to her strengths that they were into. So I at first sort of dismissed it because I wasn't crazy about The Husband's Secret, but then this has been pretty high on my list since then. So
yeah, it's really good. I think a lot of people have read it, but I know a lot of people who haven't, so that's why I decided to talk about it, because I think that there are people who either didn't know what the story was about or dismissed it thinking that it wasn't of interest to them.
Yeah.
But she's just an interesting writer, and she's somebody who shines a light on people and really shows people as they actually are. They're not sort of cardboard cutouts or stereotypes of people. And especially this is something you could definitely have a stereotype of what we call, you know, soccer moms or whatever, you know, the women who take care of their kids and focus so much of their attention on their children.
Mm-hmm.
And it could definitely be a stereotypical portrayal, and it's not. These people are very realistic, and the problems that they deal with are very realistic. And then you have, I know you like mysteries,
yes.
So there's that element of the mystery.
Yeah.
And this is, like I said, going to be a show on HBO, and it involves Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman. They both have production companies, and they're producing it, and they're also going to star in it.
Oh, okay.
And Reese Witherspoon, it's interesting, she is somebody who has done a lot for books into movies, particularly books featuring women. She was the producer of Gone Girl. She produced and starred in Wild, which I thought was an excellent, excellent adaptation of a book into a movie. I really liked it. And Luckiest Girl Alive, which we talked about last week, she has optioned that for her film company. And if you follow her on Instagram, it's fun because she'll post what she's reading. She's obviously a big reader. She's not I don't think she's somebody who she has some staffer picking out what books are going to be turned into movies. I really think she seems like a true reader.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of neat, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice to have an advocate for books
that
is in high places.
Yes. Exactly. So like I said, I have no idea when that's coming out, but it is planned for an HBO. HBO has bought the rights to it and will be filming it. So
I think that's like, I feel like there's a lot of stuff that's coming out right now that's sort of looking at modern parenting, but more not so exactly how people parent, but how parents interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's always been something that probably has been of interest to people, but it seems like it's taken a new level of sort of the Pinterest type of parent,
mm-hmm.
and the helicopter parent, that's sort of a new development. And the fact that people have a voice through social media all the time to sort of spout their feelings on parenting, that you get a lot of conflict through that. So there was that show The Slap that came out
that
I think is a remake from an Australian
show. And based on a book.
Yeah, and very interesting. So it all sort of feels like a new topic that can kind of really be delved into.
Yeah.
Big Little Lies is also doing the same thing.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think also in previous generations, the parents were more distanced from the children and their activities. Like, I don't think they were quite as involved in the day-to-day goings-on of the schoolwork and the social life and the sports or extracurricular activities that children were partaking in. And so I think that's part of it, too, is it becomes somewhat of an identity for the parents of what their kids are doing and how successful their children are. And so there's a lot to be examined there about what it says about the parents and how they are treating their children or other parents. Like in this case, the kids are fine.
Right.
It's the parents that are causing trouble. I don't know, I think, and like I said, I don't have kids. I'm not mom taking her kids every day to school. And I found it fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I found it really interesting. But I just like her writing style as well. I think easy to read. But that wraps up our portion of recommendations for some books that have either been turned into movies or TV shows or will be turned into TV shows or movies. And now let's talk about what we're reading. And tell me what you're reading.
I just started a book called The Wrath and the Dawn by Renee Adea. And this is a YA book. It came out at the beginning of May, I think. And it's basically just a retelling of 1001 Nights, which is the classic folklore collection, which has the basic premise, if you're not familiar with it, that it's a king that marries a new girl every day, then kills her that night. He eventually marries a woman named Scheherazade who saves her life by telling part of the story every night and leaving the ending out. So the king is intrigued enough to allow her to stay alive the next night, and eventually she just survives. So the book takes these standard details of the story and then imagines if they're not what they seem. So, which is always kind of a fun way of looking at retelling. So in this story, the king is 18 years old. His name is Khalid, and he marries a new girl each day and then has her killed that night. And the Scheherazade character is named Shahrzad, and she volunteers to marry Khalid after her best friend is one of his victims. So this marriage, it's not, I guess every time I've heard 1001 Nights described, it seemed a little more, or just fairy tales in general, it seems like people, the trope of someone who is trying to marry royalty and everyone else has died in the attempt, but there's one person that's kind of plucky and clever enough to be able to survive. It always seems like they're sort of self-serving and trying to become royalty themselves. And this case, that's not the way the story is told at all. She's there for revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really focused, her motivation is not focused at all on her trying to rise up in the world at all. It's just her trying to stop a monster and to protect the women of the kingdom, which to me is a very interesting premise.
That's
so
more intriguing than her trying to become royalty.
Right. So the story starts right after they've been married, and she tells her story and has him intrigued and is able to stay alive until the next day. And this continues for a while, and then they start to build some kind of relationship. As the story goes on, I haven't finished it yet, so I don't know the answers to these questions, but you realize that and there's a little bit of foreshadowing at the beginning, you realize that the deaths aren't what they seem, and that Khalid is not what he seems.
Oh.
And so it isn't just that he's kind of a bloodthirsty maniac that can kill women for sport, there's more to it than the story would make you believe from the surface. So I'm really excited to finish it. I'm about halfway through now, and it's their relationship is starting to develop into something other than just them hating each other. And that's also a trope that you see in so much chick lit and romance novels, and I usually get kind of annoyed by that, but in this case there's good reason for it, and so far I really enjoy it. And the language is just really beautiful. The setting is this lush oasis kind of feel, and so you have all of the kind of intriguing feelings of Middle Eastern culture and this gorgeous language that goes along with that, with the story that's really compelling and interesting. So far, so good. I'm reading it for a book club, and I'm really excited to talk about it. I think that the kind of the feminist twist on this is a really good choice that she's making.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating.
Yeah, and I think it's the first in a series.
Oh,
at least on Goodreads, it says number one. So, but it just came out, so I don't know what the intention is of how long the series will be or what will happen with this, but I hope that it will lead to lots of good things.
Yeah, sounds really good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, my book is Suddenly One Summer by Julie James. And I've talked before about how I like romance novels. And there are particular times in my life where I like them a whole lot more than any other type of book. And these past few weeks have been one of those times. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot going on. It's been a little bit stressful. It's been about 100 degrees outside. Yeah. And I've tried to pick up a few books that have more complicated or complex plots, and it's like I just cannot concentrate.
Right.
And then I picked up this book, and Julie James writes a lot of romances, or she's written romances with lots of witty banter and characters who are successful in their careers. They're usually in their mid-30s, and they're not, you know, wide-eyed, naive people. They're very successful, particularly the women. I like the way she writes women because they've always worked hard and they're successful in their own right, but maybe a little bit insecure in their personal lives, but in their professional lives, they've got it down. And so it's really fun. And they're all set in Chicago, and I have family that lives in Chicago, so it's always fun to read about places that I recognize. Oh, the other thing is many of her books are loosely connected. So a secondary character that has shown up in a previous book will then be the main character in a later book. And that's the case in this one. Somebody who's a side character in one of her early books is one of the main characters in this one. This is about a divorce lawyer. Her name is Victoria Slade, and because she has seen so many formerly happy marriages dissolve into like a bitter, just emotional wrecks at the end of the marriage as people are fighting at the end, she has decided she's not ever going to get married. She's going to stay single. She's happy in relationships where there's no expectation that eventually they'll get married. She's just, that's her plan for her life. And like I said, she's in her 30s, she's successful and totally fine with that. And then one night she is at home, she has a town home that she owns, and there's a break-in. And it's very scary, and you know, she's fine, but it's a very scary event. And so she decides to sell that town home and move into a condo that's in like a high-rise building where there's going to be more security, there are people manning the doors, so she doesn't have to worry about an intruder coming in. And when she moves in, she is still having panic attacks because of that night and the event of the break-in, but she doesn't tell anybody because she's embarrassed about it and she thinks it's something that she can control. And she meets her next-door neighbor, who is this hot guy.
Of course he is.
And his name is Ford, and he's kind of an arrogant guy, and as far as she can tell, he's a huge ladies' man. Like, he has all these women stopping by, and she's, you know, bringing home women, and she just immediately makes a judgment about him that he is just not somebody that she'd be interested in at all, and she sort of not just doesn't care about him, actively does not like this man because of what she thinks he is. And then one day she meets his sister, who is waiting for him in the hallway, and she is a single mom, has a young child, and is struggling to juggle everything she needs to juggle. She didn't realize the baby was the result of a one-night stand, and she hasn't gotten in touch with the father. She didn't realize how difficult it would be to raise a child on her own. And so she's very upset as she's waiting outside her brother's door, and Victoria sees her and invites her into her apartment for a cup of coffee or something to help settle her down. And they start talking, and Victoria offers, because she is a family lawyer, that she will try to track down the father of the baby to provide some support monetarily and other ways. And so because of that, Ford and Victoria team up. He is an investigative reporter, and so he has the skills to track people down, and she's the attorney, and so she needs to do it, you know, for part of the case. And so they reluctantly become allies because of this, and then they form a friendship and then sort of a fragile relationship, but with the expectation that it's not going to go anywhere, that they're sort of, they are obviously attracted to each other, and they still have reservations, and they both have issues and commitment problems, and she's dealing with these panic attacks. What I really like about what Julie James does is they seem like realistic problems. These aren't just impediments thrown up just to keep the characters from having their happy ever after, that you know that's part of the romance formula. You know there's going to be a happy ever after, which is why it's appealing for many people to read. This is like a $1 billion industry of romance books. So that, you know, that that's where it's going, but she doesn't make it, sometimes it's very contrived of why people can't be together. I mean, we talked about that when, in our first episode of the Jenny Colgan book, like, you know, there are people that are communicating for reasons, and you want to be like, just talk to each other. These are legitimate reasons of why people might not end up together. And so you, it's just really absorbing and funny. Like I said, she has a way of writing banter back and forth that's really fun, and it was just an enjoyable ride to take with the characters, and they're just generally good people with realistic problems, and a joy to see them work that out and then eventually come together.
Oh, that sounds lovely for summer.
It was perfect.
It was so nice.
I was sitting by the pool and I read it, and it made me so happy after having kind of a stressful few weeks. Okay, and so before we finish up, let's go back and talk about what we read today.
Okay. So my first book was The Enchanted April by Elizabeth von Arnim. And I also meant to mention when I described it that there's a new book coming that just came out this month called Enchanted August, which is a modern retelling of Enchanted April. And that's by Brenda Bowen. I haven't read it, but it's set in Maine. It sounds lovely. and then I also recommended Written in Blood by Caroline Graham, and The City of Ember by Jean Duprow. And what I'm reading this week is The Wrath in the Dawn by Renee Adaya.
And my books this week were The Martian by Andy Weir, Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Big Little Lies by Leanne Moriarty, and the book I'm reading is Suddenly One Summer by Julie James. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at wellreadpod@gmail.com or on Twitter at wellreadpodcast. Please rate and review us on iTunes or your other podcatcher of choice. It helps other people find the show, and we welcome all feedback and suggestions. Our theme music is Kitten by Poddington Bear. We keep all of our show notes at beaufortcountylibrary.org/wellread. That's beaufortcountylibrary.org/well-read, where you can find a listing of every book we have talked about in this episode, as well as links to movie trailers and maybe some other fun things. Thank you all for listening, and happy reading.